Welcome to Season 5 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by Allplay. If you've been following my social media, aka Token Gay Mer, you'll see that my Allplay gaming table gets used on the daily when I'm not flying to different conventions. Between hosting meals on it as a dining room table or removing the panels and adding the cup holders for a Friday night game night as a board gaming table, it gets used constantly. It's also perfect for being a working station for me building my ridiculous amount of prototypes. It honestly gets used more than I ever would have expected. Not to mention, it's great for hiding games and their pieces from my cats. Sans is my little box sitter, while Nova tries to steal the dice as Banshee watches from high atop the cat tower. I've caught them attempting to take dice from Allplay's Sequoia and Mountain Goats, two of my favorite Allplay games that my non-gamer friends adore. We play a lot of party games, and these two, they don't mind me taking out instead. So check out Allplay's tables, bags, playmats, and board games at allplay.com. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 107, Monkey Palace. Today, we are joined by David Gordon, a game designer as well as a new publisher with Up Games. Congratulations on the new publishing, but also welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Danielle. It is such an honor. I'm so excited to be here. I've listened to this podcast. I probably have listened to just about every one of these podcasts so since the beginning, and it's always been kind of fun to imagine what it would be like to be on the show, and it's a little bit surreal to be actually doing it.
And to do it with like a Lego game, that's pretty freaking awesome.
I am very excited about it. It has been such an exciting project, and I really thank you so much for inviting me to talk about it.
Oh, heck yeah. And I mean, first, for anyone who doesn't know you, how did you end up getting into designing board games?
Well, I think I have a slightly different path than some others. I was not a huge gamer. Leading into the holiday vacation of 2018 in December, I suggested to my kids that maybe we not be on our phones for the whole vacation, and maybe we design a board game together. And so we spent the vacation making maps and spreadsheets and playtesting. I had played a bunch of games as a kid. I've always loved games, but I didn't know what I was doing. And then my kids went back to school and I kept designing games, and I just loved it. And I was really fortunate to happen on the New York City Game Designers Group, which is a group of game designers who play each other's games, play test each other's prototypes. I met Gil Hova, who was pretty indicative of the industry in how generous and open and supportive. He said, if you're designing a game, then you're a game designer, and you're, of course, welcome. The first time I went, I met Tam, who ended up becoming a really good friend and co-designer on Monkey Palace. And I pretty much started going twice a week in that 2019, and it was an education. So I learned a lot about the landscape of games. I learned a lot about what to call things. I didn't know what to call things. That was really, really helpful. It's just been such a nonstop thrill to meet so many incredible people and just be able to spend my days working on design, working on these projects, and interacting with the people in the industry. It's been life-changing.
I remember we met digitally in 2020 because they reached out to like Origins at the time, or Gamma, who runs Origins, reached out to all the like remote playtest groups because we had brought ours online first before a lot of the other people did. And that's kind of how we got to know each other. I'm glad that you decided to make your kids not be on their phones. So that's pretty cool. Low-key origin story.
Exactly. Yeah. That experience working with you and with Ben Beagle and Heather O'Neill.
I know. And it turning into NenPub, which was UnPub. I mean, that's what I say started me off early in my career. So it's kind of cool that our paths met when we were designing in different areas and then met digitally. And then I actually moved to the East Coast. So I got to harass you occasionally and have been to this group in person. So anyone who lives in the New York area should definitely check it out. It's a cool group of humans.
Oh yeah. If you're designing a game, then you're a game designer and you're welcome. And, you know, look us up. Lots of people come with their first design, and there's a range of how well the design is working, whether it's your first time or whether it's your 300th time, you know, you can bring a game. So don't be shy.
I miss that, honestly, being closer to design groups, because all of my designing, I feel like, is on an island. I'm either doing digital or getting friends or I don't know, people at my gym to playtest stuff or go to a convention. So I'm pretty envious that you live close by.
Are you not near Boston and close enough?
I'm an hour and a half away, so not really that close. It'd be a thing where I'd have to like work in the office and then drive up or something afterwards, which has not happened yet. That has just not been a priority of mine. But, you know, let's move off of me and back over to you. How did you and Tam land designing the like modern day Lego game Monkey Palace? Like, I need to know all the things about this. And everyone listening.
That's a big question. So Tam and I had been incredibly fortunate to meet Luke Peterschmidt and show him some games at an Origins, I believe in the summer of 2022. And that was when he and Brian von Mueller showed some interest in a game that Tam and I had called Crafting the Cosmos. We worked with Brian very closely for a while, for a long time, developing that game. And became very good friends with Brian, who is a really incredible and talented developer. And I mean, he just really made a huge impact on that game. And also, I learned so much working with him. When LEGO and Asmodee worked out their agreement to produce LEGO games, and I have no idea any of those details, the studio that was selected from Asmodee to publish the game was a Danish studio called Bezawizer. They subsequently formed a studio called Dotted Games, specifically for the LEGO games. And they asked around, Asmodee is a big network, a big company, they asked around for some suggestions. And my understanding is that Brian recommended Tam and me as good designers to work with. So that is such an honor we owe Brian, to take him out for lunch, like every time I ever see him for the rest of my life. So that was fantastic. And so what that did, though, was that let Bezawizer, or, you know, the Dotted Games folks, they had a brief, which is a kind of summary of things they're looking for in a game. And a lot of the larger publishers will have these briefs and send them out to all the designers in their network. So basically that opened the door to get this brief and look at it. And then Tam and I spent all of our time thinking about how to make this game. We playtested it, we iterated, we debriefed, we playtested, iterated, debriefed many times over the course of probably, I don't know how long, but when we felt it was stable and it was there was a spark of magic in there that we liked, we submitted the proposal. It was just about when the deadline was. Like, we, I think, just made it.
How long was that period of time? Was it like a month or?
It was not long.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like they're normally pretty short. It's like in 1 or 2 weeks or maybe a month. So it's like, really, unless you had something similar you could repurpose, it's pretty hard to hit.
It was pretty hard to hit. Yeah. So we're very lucky. It was a very short period of time. Tam grew up with Lego, playing Lego.
I am unsurprised by this.
Yes.
Our Mr. Build It.
I won't speak for him, but he has told me that he didn't have a lot of toys when he was a kid, and so he had to be creative with Lego. I similarly had a childhood growing up with Lego. My brother and I would build these big cities, so I had Lego as part of my life all through my childhood. And I actually still had in my basement 4 enormous bins of random pieces, which was not a small benefit or asset for us, because when we started coming up with an idea, we went down to my basement and we just looked for the pieces, those arches. We got all the arches we could find and all of the singles that we could find of the different colors. And we brought them to my table and we just sat there and worked with them. So that was actually really critical that I had access to those. And it just kind of was fortuitous that I did. I'm not sure I remember exactly what your question was, but that was.
Okay, so you got the brief, you quickly put something together, you thankfully had a background in Legos and the bin full of it in your basement. So you submit this design. How quickly did you find out that you either made it to the next round or they wanted a prototype? Like, walk me through the next part.
Yeah, actually, they got back to us pretty quickly, within a month or so. And they wrote me an email, Tam and me an email, that said they were intrigued by the concept, but they were a little dubious of whether or not it could be done. Like, they were looking at these pictures and like this, they didn't believe that it was possible that you could build this structure. So I wrote them back and said, yeah, all of these are photos or renderings from actual playtests that we've done, because I wouldn't submit you something that I hadn't tested. So then we met with them and discussed it. They played it some more, and eventually they told us that they had selected us. And I don't know how many other designers there were, but it was just an incredible honor and miraculous kind of experience to be selected. And I think we ended up signing a contract with them before the spring. Like, it was February, I think.
I remember when we were at dinner at New York Toy Fair, and quickly I realized, it's like, oh, I know some other people that got the same brief, and it had some kind of code name or something to it. It was so funny. And they're like, what? You got it? And I was like, oh, yeah.
And those are some pretty outstanding, talented designers. We were just feel very lucky.
It's one of those interesting things for anyone listening to the podcast. There are specific publishers that send out these briefs, and it is rare that a game actually comes from it, but it does happen. So sometimes it is worth putting in that energy, even though I'm not always the biggest fan of doing work for free at this point. But I'm glad it worked out for the two of you. Explain how the game is played, and then tell me what inspired the whole idea of building this temple.
Sure. And to be clear, we've never gotten other briefs that we've applied for. So it's very hard to get the briefs.
Oh, really? That's your first one?
Yeah. It's very hard to get the briefs. And you're right, they sometimes don't even go forward. So the way the game works is every player has some Lego elements. There are bridges, which are these little arches, or I guess they're called arches. And they have a little bow. I think their official Lego name might be bow. And then there's one by ones, which are these studs that you pile on top. So you're using these Lego elements to, on your turn, build a structure and attach it to the existing structure. And this was always the core concept. This was the initial concept. I don't think this changed from day one of the idea, which is that we're playing this competitive game, yet we're all contributing to create this single central structure. And that was the experience we were going for, that you'll each do your little bit. You're competing, which incentivizes bigger and taller structures. And then at the end, when it's done, you can look back and you have something that'll be different every time, will be interesting looking, and maybe you put it on your shelf. And in fact, mine just sits on the shelf. I don't ever even put it back in the box until I'm ready to play again. I just then would take it apart and play it, and then leave it on the shelf. And that was kind of our vision from day one. None of that never changed, really. It was just about, okay, well, what are we building? And so on your turn, you're trying to build this staircase where you're starting at the floor, and you're trying to use the arches to climb higher and make steps using the one by ones or the existing structure to climb on it and use those to get higher and higher. Then wherever you started on the ground, there are three different types of terrain. That terrain, there's a little marker, which are some light green leaves or dark green leaves, or there's gold nuggets. And you just put the matching one at the very top of your staircase. And then you count the number of steps that you took, the number of arches that you used, and that is your monkey points. And then you can spend those monkey points, which are ephemeral. You don't save them after the turn. You spend those to buy monkey cards, which give you more of the Lego elements. So this idea of engine building, where you're getting stronger and stronger over the course of the game, so that in round four, the opportunities, the options, the pieces that you have to build with are very different than they were in round one and round two. And that was another feeling that we wanted to have, and that I think was always there. And so at the end of the game, each of these monkey cards that you've bought, they also have banana points. Whoever has the most banana points at the end wins. So you're collecting these cards both as engine building, but also as endgame victory points. So the way that the economy of the cards are, usually the ones that give you more, better, regular income in terms of the Lego elements will have fewer points than those that will give you less. And those will usually, you know, on an ongoing basis, those will usually give you more victory points. So you have to decide at a certain point, at every point, you have to decide whether it's worth it to take this card that will give you more bananas or whether you want one that will give you more pieces to build with.
I think that was a cool idea to be doing that. But like for dotted games, what made them decide that they wanted to go towards a strategy game versus like a kid's game for Lego?
Boy, I don't know. I don't think I haven't discussed that very much with them other than talking about some games that they have in the future. And I can't really talk about them, but they may not all be strategy. It's possible.
Well, then how did playtesting look for this game? Because I know, like myself, I had to sign an NDA when I got to even look at the game. So it was very top secret. How was it showing a game and developing and playtesting under like kind of being secretive and constraints like that?
It's hard. It's hard to keep these secrets for long periods of time. And another secret just kind of got released today, which we might be able to talk about later. And, you know, these are secrets that I've had to keep for like multiple years. Very hard. I really want to tell everyone. And frankly, I'm kind of bad at it. So sometimes I will be, you know, the publishers usually, well, the first thing I said to Birgitta, who is the publisher, she's the head of Best of Wizard Dotted Games. I said, well, you know, Tam and I, we need to play test this. We're not going to make a good game if we can't play test it. And we need other people for that. And, you know, that means we're going to have to break the NDA. How does this work? And she said that I can tell friends, I can play with friends and family. I can tell friends and family as long as they know that they can't announce it. No posting, right? And that was critical. And for this other one that was announced today, it was kind of the same thing with Jamie, which I may as well say is Finspan was just announced this morning from Stonemaier Games. Also a very non-public testing and iterating over the course of its development.
How do you feel? Like, do you have a preference between working with that kind of constraint? Like, do you like the idea of, hey, this is kind of a secret, but no one can talk about it, and then, oh my God, it comes out, and it's like exciting? Or do you prefer to be able to like post or talk about whatever you want?
Well, the first gate that I go through is that I'm just ecstatic to be doing it at all, and I don't care whatever you want, I'm in. So like, I'm really feel very fortunate that I had these opportunities and a couple other ones that I have that are secret still. I just feel like fortunate, appreciative people cannot be beggars, I guess, or cannot be choosers.
I was going to say, I'm like, you can beg as much as you like.
Anyone could be a beggar. Anyone could be a beggar, but we can't be choosers. So I'm just so happy to have the chance to do it. It's very difficult and I love telling people. So take that for what it is.
That's totally fair. I personally prefer to be able to do whatever I want and post whatever pictures I want. I do not enjoy working under NDAs whatsoever. But I will do it, but I don't like it.
I don't think I would like it, especially if it were more broad. Or like if some of my friends work for, or our friends, you know them too, work for these publishers who don't even allow them to play test other people's games, let alone let you see what they're working on. And they're just like, their entire life is secretive and they're working on these projects and no one can know what they are until they come out. I don't think that would be my first choice. I mean, on the flip side, they may love, first of all, they have the opportunity to work in games, which is, I think we're all really lucky to be able to do that. So I doubt that they get a lot of joy out of it. But for me, I really like the social aspect of the game design world. I like playtesting with as many people as possible, and I like talking to people about design and solving problems while we're, in a restaurant or something. Like, I want to be able to talk.
No, that's totally fair. And how long did it go from, like, that initial brief and you guys coming up with the idea to the game coming out this past year? Now we're in a new year.
We had to have all of the components fixed by the end of June of 23. We, I guess, had the first ideas in the late 22. So you're looking at 6 months, 7 months till the components are fixed. Then there's still some work that you can do on rules and still some work that you can do on the little expansion, micro expansions, the butterfly, like what does the butterfly do, that kind of stuff we could do after that. But Once the fall hit, then they were pretty much like, once you have a, like within a year, I think to do a project this big, I think you're really into, you're obviously doing the art and you're doing graphic design and you're doing, you need so much time for rules and for all the different elements that all has to be done before the production, the manufacturing. And that's going to need 3 to 6 months, probably closer to six.
So were you and Tam the main developers for the game, or did you have someone assigned to be your developer?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. We actually worked very closely with Jonas Resting Jeppesen, who is the head of development for Bezawizer and Dotted Games. We worked closely with Jonas, just as we had with Brian von Mueller for Crafting the Cosmos. We worked with Jonas very frequently, intensively, for an extended period of time and become really good friends with Jonas. Jonas is also an extremely talented and knowledgeable designer and developer, and he led the development. So Tam and I were very happy that we were able to be involved, and there was nothing in the game that they just like said, okay, we're just putting this in and, you know, we'll get back to you when it's done. It was all a discussion. It was all a group effort. In fact, included in that experience was also Jaume Fabregat from LEGO. He was the LEGO liaison and from the LEGO group. He is he's the board games lead, I think it was his title. And he is also super knowledgeable. You wouldn't expect somebody who is a LEGO person, works for the LEGO group as an executive or whatever, what have you, to be so knowledgeable. But he knows his games. He knows hobby games. And he had very good insights in those meetings. He also would run tests between games with LEGO enthusiasts that he had access to. So he was extremely helpful. And the combination of the four of us and also another developer they brought on, Jeppe Christensen, was really great. So it was quite a team and fairly intensive because we had to get it locked in a very short amount of time.
Why did they have such a short timeline?
I think if you just work it backwards, like I said, if the manufacturing is going to take, let's say, 6 months, because it is a fairly large worldwide print run, you have to do the localization of the translations of all the languages. You have to do the graphic design and editing. I think all of that takes probably 3 to 6 months. And then you have the art, which probably takes another 3 to 6 months. Now we're already 18 months out. And they wanted to release it at Essen 2024. So I guess, you know, there were many period points along the way when I thought that we weren't going to make it. I thought, okay, they're just going to pull this because that was a really bad test. And sometimes it takes a bad test to kind of bring it back and know what doesn't work. But though that always happens, and somehow we got it to work, and somehow it ended up working, getting it done in time. But I think if it hadn't, I thought they might just pull it. But probably in retrospect, they would have just pushed it to fall of 25 instead of 24. I don't know. Who knows?
How did it feel to go to Spiel and see your game as like one of the largest booths?
Incredible. It was ridiculous. It's hard to find the words to explain it because this was the first game of mine that was sold on the market or published. So I had never seen a game of mine being played by people who bought it before.
Yeah, let alone it being the theme of the entire booth.
Right. And like when you walk in, it's there and people, you know, Dr. Reiner Knizia is walking up and saying, oh, that's really great. And meeting him and taking pictures and people asking me for autographs. It's just very weird. It's very surreal. I mean, you know this, how this is, you know, what this is like from your experiences, but it was definitely fun.
Your guys' booth setup was awesome. Especially how many games did they put into that one giant palace that was built? Like, everyone kept looking at it.
Yeah, 80.
Oh, there's 80 copies. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. But they're all legal moves.
No way. So they seriously, did they get like real Lego people to do it?
Or oh, yeah.
Or was it just gamers? Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. Real nice. Lego people.
Oh, that's so fun. And are people receiving the game well?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know what metric you would use. People always, you know, nobody's come up to me and said that your game sucks.
and that's good.
So that's a start. But no, I think, you know, I've seen lots of reviews that are very flattering. I've seen it won the Belgian Toy Federation Game of the Year for 2024, which was thrilling. And it has gotten a lot of acclaim from media and reviews. So I don't know, you know, beyond that, but I think the reception has been pretty great. I think people are surprised. Like, that's one thing that I've seen as a theme. They're surprised that the game is as much a game as it is.
Not like a gimmick like Mousetrap, where you're just really building a Rube Goldberg machine.
Exactly, right. Yeah, like, so I think that's the key to the success of the game, if there's going to be success, which is that it can provide an experience that you want to play over and over. And I've seen people write to me, and they've said, or I've just seen posts, not even writing to me, but just posts of people who say, I bought it with my family, we've played it 20 times, and we just keep playing it. So they're finding new strategies and new ideas and new ways of blocking, new ways of constructing, new ways of mitigating the cards that are available and managing them. And so, yeah, it's fantastic.
Do you have like a favorite and a least favorite moment from the design journey for this game?
It was fun to be able to play it with you and with other prominent designers along the way. I played it with Elizabeth Hargrave. I played it with Jonathan Gilmore Long. I played it with some really established and knowledgeable designers. And that was always a thrill and a lot of fun to be able to share this secret with people who I look up to. So that was definitely a high.
Then you're low.
You really want me to give you a low?
Yeah. I think like that's the point of design. There's not only ever highs. Otherwise, when you have that low, it's going to be a lot farther to fall.
That's true. And that's fair. I think probably I alluded to it before, but I think probably the fact that playtests, when they don't go the way you expect, failing playtests, I think would be the low. And there were several of them, like I mentioned, that I personally, in my mind, thought that this was just not going to work. I thought maybe this would end up getting pulled. And that's really like the idea that you have this incredible opportunity and then you might fail. That feels really bad.
Yeah. I've definitely been there with a publisher too, where I'm like, oh, I got this awesome game. It's coming out at this time period. And then they like give you an email and you're like, oh God, are they going to drop it? No, please. And so at this point, I just don't talk as much about the games I have signed, because until it's like actually going to print, I am just holding my breath at this point. I've heard so many stories of games getting returned or like companies going under for one reason or another. It's just like, you never know.
Yeah. And I've had several games returned as well. It's just part of what you're doing, part of the industry. But the thing is that in this industry, every time I've had something returned, or every time I've had a pitch that didn't go well, or a pitch that went fine and they just still passed, is that the publishers are so friendly and supportive. I've gotten actionable feedback that makes me a better designer. And I think that's the key thing to focus on in those moments, is to learn, just keep learning and getting better if you can.
Do you have another piece of advice, or do you want that to be your piece of advice for designers?
I think my piece of advice for designers, I mean, certainly that, I think that's just a life lesson, but I think for design, and this is also another life lesson, if I may say so myself, is that a lot of designers talk to me about, you know, how to get their game published. They talk about how they may be struggling, they're having trouble, they're not getting their game signed. And I definitely felt this for the first, I mean, I went the first few years without getting anything signed. I would get interest from a publisher and then they would pass. And I think the most important thing that helped me through that was that playtesting, the feedback, the craft, and getting better at it, that's the part I enjoy, this, the interaction with the other designers. If I focus on that as the part of this that I like to do, then I don't have to care about whether or not I get something signed. And it's okay if it takes longer. And that if my goal is to get something signed, I'm going to be miserable, because it's you sign very small percentage of the games that you make or that you pitch, and an even smaller percentage of the games that you make. It's almost like I would put the analogous to have it be, make it analogous to baseball. A baseball hitter, you know, the best hitters in the world get a hit approximately one out of three times. So that means that the Ted Williams and Babe Ruths of the world are failing two thirds of the time. And so they have to like the act of doing what they're doing, because if they're just relying on only being happy when they get hits, they're going to be sad most of the time.
I think that's a great way to look at it. I know that when I had Ellie Dix on here, it's like she kind of talked about expecting a no, like planning for a no. And when a yes comes up, it's just like an added bonus. But I think that's always really good because you and I have very similar puppy dog energy. You're a beagle, I'm a golden retriever. And we get very excited. And when cool, like we come out of a meeting or something, we want to talk about it and be like, oh, this was great and this and this. And then I've had it happen so often where I came out of a great meeting, had some awesome follow-up, and then just nothing. Got ghosted or whatever. And it's just like a thing that all designers, like if you are pitching your games, like enjoy it, appreciate those fun moments, but also don't let like yourself get wrapped up in those moments, because it gets a little disappointing when you get ghosted or like the game comes back. But it's like each time a game comes back, you're getting feedback typically, and the game's only going to get better from it, or you just as a designer are leveling up regardless.
Yeah, I think that's the key. And I would take the collecting no's one step further. A long time ago in my early work years, I did a lot of sales and I did some phone sales part-time, which was really challenging. But I think the percentages are probably similar. If I'm successful in phone sales, I will be getting one or two successes out of 100. I think that's probably similar to pitching. Maybe it's three or four. When I was doing that, if I'm sitting there for 5 hours, I want as many no's as possible, because if I can get 99 no's, then I'm due for a yes. And the no's are good. Give me a no. Yes, thank you. Another no. I need more no's. I'll never get to my yes if I don't sift through 45 no's.
I agree. I did. Oh gosh, this was the worst. But I was an admissions person at a college because I wanted to get my grad school paid for by the school. But I couldn't do it because eventually my soul just started getting sucked because of how many conversations I had to have with individuals if they actually stayed on the phone with me. Because majority of the time they hung up or they cussed me out or whatever. But the few that stayed on the phone and got all the way to the point where they actually applied to the school was so small. Like my numbers, like having 10 people per semester actually apply to the school was a good number. And so it was so difficult to have these conversations with these potential students. But me, I couldn't do it because as soon as I heard something that made me think they weren't a good fit for our school, but maybe something else, I always wanted to be honest with the person, which did actually make my percentages higher than a lot of the other admissions advisors. But I also ended up, anytime someone would screen one of those calls, they'd be like, Danielle, you basically talked them out of it. And I was like, yeah, but that's because they were looking to go to med school and we don't offer a program like that. Like it's just not a good fit for them. Like why would we make them spend all this money and go in debt? So it's like my soul couldn't do it, but it was like really good practice on getting rejected constantly.
Yeah, I think a good salesperson doesn't want to make a sale that's going to make somebody unhappy. They want to make a good fit. So I think that's universal.
I would hope so. I definitely think it's a good skill set to have, though, going into pitching games. Well, you've already alluded to / talked about one of your games coming out, but I know you have a bunch of other stuff that fans should be looking out for. So tell us about what's going on with you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let me see. So I mentioned FinSpan. It's coming out very soon. It was announced today. It's been just an incredible experience to work with Stonemaier, and really excited about that. At some point this spring, I have a game called Making Monsters, which is going to be on Kickstarter, and that's really exciting. It's a co-design with Jonathan Gilmore Long. In, I believe, March, a game designed by Christopher Ryan Chan of The Night Cage and Tam. We triple co-designed a game called Push Push Penguin, which was picked up by this really interesting new publishing company that you might know about.
Yeah, you're funny. So he's talking about the imprint of Wise Wizard Games, which is the company I work for, Wacky Wizard Games. So that's going to be our fourth game in the line. So very excited.
And then also in March, I mentioned Crafting the Cosmos is coming out with Office Dog. And then in March, also Floristry is coming out. Floristry is the first game from the studio that you mentioned at the beginning of the show called Up Games, which I formed about a year and a half ago with Ammon Anderson of Gnome Hollow, Tam, who I've mentioned a few times, and Greg May, who is a board game cafe proprietor in New York. And we are putting this game, Floristry, on the market. We are partnering with Asmodee for distribution and couldn't be more excited about this. Hopefully you'll check it out when it comes out and you'll see. If you want more information about it, you can go to upgamesatplay.com.
Sweet. Up stands for something, right? Was it like Uncommon Publishing? I'm trying to remember.
Uncommons Publishing, okay, is Uncommons. The original. Yeah, so Greg, one of Greg's board game cafes is called The Uncommons, which is a well-known board game cafe in New York City.
And so that's a lot going on in March. Anything else that you want to plug and talk about?
Yeah, I don't have specific names, but there's a game coming out in the summer from Foundling Skeleton, another one in the hopefully in the fall from Mighty Boards. And then it's possible there's another one coming out in the fall. And then several things in 26, but you can see the list on my BGG page if you want.
Basically, what we've learned is David was someone no one knew, and then all of a sudden, boom, all the games.
It's been pretty ridiculous, yeah.
Yeah, that is fun. I know I've teased you before because it's like, you technically had a game come out, but you were correct in the way that you did not sell it, and it was a gift at a wedding, but the one you made for John and Tara's wedding was cute.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, John and Tara gave me a design credit on that, and I worked with John on it. But, you know, this was their game. This was their wedding game. It was really fun to work on and an honor. And maybe somebody will do something more with it.
No, you've got a lot of really cool publishers putting out some of your games. So I'm excited for you. It's really great that you're seeing all this success. And hey, hopefully it'll keep going. But also knowing, like anyone else, that no one's worth is attached to what they're doing. Because, I mean, we're all going to go through ups and downs as you have your ups games. But
yeah, well, thank you. And, you know, you in no small part have been a big factor in my development as a designer. You always have really great feedback, and we've play tested a ton together, and I really appreciate that support, and I appreciate your believing in Push Push Penguin for Wacky Wizards.
Oh, totally. It's been fun getting to develop one of the games that you guys all designed and seeing how it's changed over the years, because I remember when I first saw it at some like small convention in Long Island, I was like, oh, this is kind of cute. And then when we started up Wacky, I was like, hey, guys, do you still have that game? Because I remembered it still. So you made a good prototype. And as designers listening, just like, you never know who you might be playtesting a game with or like what impression you might leave on a person. I've reached out to people in the past where I'm like, oh, I remember this thing that you were doing. Like, where is it at? And, you know, sometimes it's available, which is pretty cool.
Oh, my. You don't know who you're sitting next to. Like, you don't know at a convention who the person is at the table with you. You might be sitting next to the head of games for some really large studio and not know it. You might be sitting next to any number of people in the industry, because so everybody is so friendly and down to earth and just there and present. Everybody is working together to contribute to a better landscape of games in this industry. And what a gift.
Totally. Well, David, for my last question, unrelated to everything we've talked about, what's a game you wish you had been the designer of?
I thought about this a little bit because I've listened to almost every one of your shows.
Yeah.
And I think it's changed as I've listened. I think I'm going to go with The Mind because, first of all, the first time I saw The Mind, I immediately felt jealous. So that's like, there's a threshold. When I see a game and I'm like, oh my God, why didn't I think of that? That's definitely the thing, first step. But because of the sheer elegance of all you do, there's no rules. You just can't show your cards to anyone else, but you can play anytime. I love the idea of a real-time game with no clock. In fact, Tam and I are working on one of those right now that I'm very excited about.
Of course you are.
I'm very excited about that. And I think it's probably inspired by that. So that'd be it. There's not a lot there to that one.
That would not have been my guess for you, but
really, what would you have thought?
Just, I don't know, not that one. I feel like so many people argue whether or not it's a game. It's not the first time it's come up as someone's answer on the podcast, but I just think it's funny. But I do like your sentiment of anytime I'm jealous I didn't make something, I'm like, ooh, that means it's a good game. It's going to stick in my head.
Yes. Yeah.
There's a game currently I'm trying to get signed for our company that's like that. And I was like, guys, I can't stop thinking of this prototype. And it's rare for me to like play a prototype and think that. So.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, hopefully we end up signing it. But I appreciate you being on the show. And everyone listening, thanks for joining us for this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 107, Monkey Palace. And thanks, David, for being on the show. For anyone trying to follow you and all the games you got dropping this year, where can they find you?
I think Facebook is probably the best at this point. You can just search for my name and it's the same picture as on my BGG page. So whichever one looks like that and has like 80 common friends in common with you is probably the right one.
Awesome. So yeah, search David Gordon on the Facebook.
Yes.
Perfect. And then I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're trying to find me, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky under Token Gamer. And that's GAYMER. I also have a website, dmarcreativegroup.com, as well as like BGG. I always forget that we have that. Like you can put all your upcoming games on there. I think I need to update it though.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's useful.
I would agree. But thanks for being on the show, man. This was great.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. It's fun.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcast.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out All Play at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.